You're listening to Future Thinking from Stylists, the show where our analysts, alongside industry thought leaders, unpack the big trends you need to know about. Find out more about what the future holds for your business at stylists.com.
Hello, and welcome to Future Thinking from Stylists. I'm your host, Leila Petra. In today's episode, I spoke to Stylists' senior trends editor for pop culture and media, Annie Corsa, to unpack some of the key directions and significant trends featured in our Pop Culture and Media Futures 24-25 report. From the resurgence of retro gaming and apps revitalizing social connections, to AI synthfluences and a Gen Z-led revival in romance publishing, we explore how these directions are impacting the future to come. The past few years, I think we've really seen this wave of cultural nostalgia hitting. I think the Y2K comeback has certainly dominated the scene in terms of aesthetics and trends, etc. And I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. This must be undoubtedly bleeding into the digital world, where we're now seeing audiences really seeking out nostalgic content. So how are you seeing this show up and culminate within the entertainment realm?
So the nostalgia, we're very used to the term now. There's nostalgia that sort of permeated pop culture for 5+ years now. It's basically scooped up everything from the 80s, the 90s, the noughties. We're actually in the 2010s, like we're being invited to be nostalgic 2014 now, which is galling. But one way to refine it in terms of how it's affecting people's behavior and what they're talking about and the entertainment they're seeking is to think of digital nostalgia. So that is yearning for tech and digital experiences from the early internet, early social media, early sort of mass market gadgetry time. So these are things that feel simpler, joy and play that feels more uncomplicated. It's stuff that we perceive as untouched by the complicated reality that we experience because we all have iPhones. And a really key manifestation of that is retro gaming. So this is millions of people playing the first mass market video game, The Hedgehog, Super Mario, Street Fighter, stuff like that. So those things for lots of people conjure up these ideas of simpler joys. And the technology is allowing people to do this. So now we've got emulators, which are apps that let you turn your device into an old console. So these are not permitted for a new console because that would be copyright theft, basically. But you can do it for stuff that's not on the market, like an old Nintendo or the early PlayStation. But there's also things like Amstream Arcade, and now you can stream thousands of retro games just on your phone. There's such an appeal for it that GameStop, which I think originally was quite anti this, because a lot of the companies in gaming, they don't necessarily want people to revert the stuff that they're no longer selling. But GameStop is now, they're going to open some physical stores that are specifically selling retro games. There's just this huge appetite for it. It's also, as with a lot of this digital nostalgia, where they're talking about not wanting to be in the current moment, they're doing that on the current platform. So it's huge on TikTok, retro gaming. People are following accounts about retro consoles and people watching people play retro games. There's also filters where you can transform any image into sort of PlayStation 2. It's a big cultural movement.
Quite interesting to see that people just reverting back to that. And it's good to hear that some brands are really embracing it as well. Running with the idea that these cohorts have this huge appetite for, like we say, the simpler time before social media. I think the report also shines a light on not only gaming, but also these different apps and platforms that are really feeding into this and going against more of these super apps like Instagram and TikTok. Could you talk us through some examples of those nostalgic apps that you've seen?
Definitely. So yeah, I think the thing that people are pushing against is the super app thing, is it? They feel like social media has become entertainment, so no longer about connection, and these apps have deprioritized them. They don't want to do 1,000 things on Instagram. They just want to see what their friends are up to. So there are apps that are focusing on this sort of single purpose connected things where, yeah, the sense of friends coming first. The key one is No Place. And this is an app specifically models on the ethos and the sort of look and feel of MySpace, which was the early social networking site that every millennial will know. In fact, actually, this app was called No Space, but it had to change its name for legal reasons. But on No Place, users that you manually create a profile, you do lists for top friends and top songs like you would have done on MySpace. The aesthetic's super simple. It's very Y2K friendly. It's also mostly text posting, so you're not just scrolling images. It's a really interesting example of this concept called anemoia, which is yearning for a past you didn't experience, which basically powers a lot of this nostalgia for Gen Z. They weren't teenagers in the 90s and early noughties, but they want those experiences. And No Place was founded by a 23-year-old. She never used MySpace, but she feels this pull to what it offered. It was actually the number one app when it launched this summer, and that was powered almost entirely by Gen Z. Another one that I really love called PIFYI. So this is originally from a recommendations newsletter called Perfectly Imperfect, which blew up during the pandemic. It's got something like 600,000 subscribers. It's now a social media platform. It's also, again, really lo-fi, really early noughties aesthetic. It's also mostly text posts. You can post images, but they're static. You can't edit them. There's no sort of manipulation going on. And also users search for the recommendations they want based on their interests. So it's this sort of anti-algorithm idea. You're not just being served stuff because it might go viral or the most amount of people might want it. It really is for niche interests. And that's the point of these friends and interests first apps.
Looking more into the future now, less retrospectively into the past with these apps, I think a fascinating subject that was brought up in the report was this idea of a new wave of social media, more specifically this kind of integration of hyper-realistic and responsive AI influencers, which was just really interesting. From my own knowledge, I know there's AI Instagram influencers like Lil Miquela and Shudu Graham, but I appreciate they're probably just the beginning of what's to come. And in today's digital age, with kind of social media influencers holding this immense power in influencing consumer behavior, how are you seeing these things advancing?
It is a fascinating space, and it really dovetails with a lot of the research that's also come out of our macro trend series, Life in AI. One thing, things about like Lil Miquela, virtual influencers have been around for a while, but they are essentially just artistic representations of people. The thing with AI is that they can be semi-autonomous and they can act independently. This is generative AI, which creates a completely different world, really. So they are hyper-realistic looking, but they can interact with each other as well. So the key thing that I've learned is that there's a real difference between the AI that people are willing to, like consumers are willing to play with and create with, even interact with, when it's of their design and when it feels like it's in a casual creativity sense or like a social media setting. So there's an app called Butterflies, which is like Instagram, but what you do is you go on, you create your own profile, and then you can create basically an infinite number of AI avatar influencer characters. These characters are called Butterflies. And these, they have their own profiles and you give them a personality and you set them off and they act independently and they will interact with other butterflies. They'll generate images, they'll post comments, they'll send DMs, they'll build their own followings, they try and become influencers. And it's basically entertainment for humans, but also it's showing you what Gen AI can do. The point being that the user, the human, is the puppet master. And there's a lot of fun to be had there. It's a sort of the shift in what we think of social media. Some people are going back to places like No Place because they want more human connection. Some people are really interested in what this synthetic world's going to look like, and so they'll be going to Butterflies. But it's really different when it comes to how these hyper-realistic AI influencers are used in terms of brand influence, because here people are still are really concerned about authenticity. A third of global Gen Z who are, it varies from survey to survey, but in lots of ways curious about AI, they say that they're distrustful of AI just because of a lack of authenticity. So a brand approach really needs to consider that. How do you carry authenticity over to the AI influencers? And one way to ensure that, or to hedge against that, is to make sure that your AI ambassadors are really drawn from real influencers. So you lend them the credibility that makes influencing work in the first place. TikTok has launched its Symphony ad suite where you can build custom avatars. So these are avatars based on real influencers, obviously with their consent and input, and they encode them with their personalities, their interests, the reason people follow them. And so then brands can expand the capacity of their partnerships. They can globalize the offer. These avatars speak multiple languages, but they're still borrowing the credibility that makes influencer outreach work. Meta's also offering a similar thing. So I think it's really important for brands to know that there's a huge amount of opportunity here, but they're aware of the difference between AI for an entertainment purpose and AI for an influencing advertising purpose. Lots of false starts, obviously, with AI and with the way that big tech companies have approached it. It's launched, it's soon as there's something like 30 AI chatbots that have the likeness of celebrities, but you weren't pretending that you were speaking to those celebrities. So it's like Kendall Jenner lent her face to it, but it was an entirely different character. The chatbot was called something different. And I think that confused people. I think people want really clear purpose. They want to know where it's come from. They don't mind artificiality if they understand what it's doing and why it's been made, I think.
More from Annie in a moment, but just a quick pause to say that for our members, you can access our full-length Pop Culture and Media Futures 24-25 report on the site and find weekly new content on our TikTok channel at We Are Stylists. And if you're not already a member and would like to find out how access to stylists could benefit your business, email innovation@stylist.com or visit www.stylist.com/membership. Now back to my interview with Annie. Moving on to another corner of social media, another interesting thing I think we're seeing playing out is currently this regression in terms of gender ideals, which I think is showing up in quite questionable content. Could you elaborate on how this kind of glamorization of toxic gender roles is showing up and how are brands even dealing with this narrative?
It's extremely interesting and it is disturbing. There's data behind this now emerging from everywhere. So in the US, UK, China, Poland, Germany, South Korea, the data shows that young women are becoming more progressive and young men more conservative. And so inevitably, it's manifesting in internet culture. It's also born from internet culture. So it's really complicated. There's, on the one hand, you've got the manosphere, which is this sort of online ecosystem where people enact toxic masculinity, essentially. So content about alpha and stigma males, about looks maxing, which is this basically this ideal physical appearance of men. There's really outdated ideals about how men and women should interact in dating, in relationships, promoted by podcasts like Good Bro, Bad Bro, and Fresh and Fit. And so that is happening. And there's this sort of toxic maelstrom happening when lots of young men are encountering this content. It's not being rebuffed and it's just becoming their reality. But then also, even while young women in the majority are becoming more progressive, there's also a growing subset that seems to also be influenced by manosphere culture. And also this group of women who seem to be performing this massive overcorrection to what they perceive as the issues with feminism, a lot of which comes back to this sort of the girl boss thing about feminism freeing you from all worries and hustle culture and all of that. But this is where we get trad wives, which is this sort of some of this very questionable content. Trad wives glamorize domestic labor. They promote marital subservience. They often present it as if this is actually feminist agency. This is what choice feminism is. A key example of that is a woman whose account called Ballerina Farm. She's got something like 20 million followers across all her platforms. And it's very bucolic. And she presents motherhood as the ultimate purpose of women. It's really alluring, attractive content, but it's extremely retrogressive. And so brands can play a really significant role here. We need really positive role models that actively talk about the issues with these gender ideals, not just wishy-washy, women can do anything, men can be strong and vulnerable. Like, it needs to be quite specific because this content is really powerful. And it may feel obvious for older generations, but it's a real mistake to assume that young people are automatically progressive. So in terms of what they can do, we've already seen partnerships happening, like an NBA player called Jared Kane partnered with US beauty brand Sally Hansen. It's really culturally significant. He's out there on his Instagram promoting his, like, wearing nail polish. Seems like a small thing, but it's just a sort of, it's really effortless and it's just no apologies pushing past this sort of manosphere pressure. So stuff like that can be really significant. We also need brands to be building spaces where young women can discuss the truth of their lives, but again, not in this sort of wishy-washy version of it. They need to specifically be talking about what appeals to them about these domestic goddesses, about these glamorized versions. Why are they watching this content? Why is it alluring to them? What pressures do they feel? Because clearly there is some appeal here. The content surrounding this growing gender culture gap is really potent. So it's really important that brands step up.
Moving into kind of another realm of pop culture, we're really seeing this revival of romance happening. And I know our Romance Boom report previously touched on the comeback of rom-com, which is now back in full swing after a somewhat cultural hiatus, as well as consumers also really devouring kind of romance fantasy-fueled books at the moment in the publishing world. So what's going on in this space, and why do you think it is that audiences can't seem to get enough?
I love this. I think my theory on this is that it is some really quite specific escapism. So escapism, not a new concept whatsoever, but why romance and why now? I think people specifically want escapism from all of the real life content they consume so avidly every day. They want a bit of unreality. And romance and romanticy offers optimism and idealism and presents these ideas of stability and home and safety and love and this idea of fulfillment from relationships. And I think that people really want that. We've actually just published a report about in our Internet Trend series about new romance, and it looks into people wanting this. They don't want complicated relationships. They don't want whatever Tinder is promoting. 80% of US Gen Z say they fantasize about monogamy. People want this stability. They also want to be carried away somewhere that feels magical. And I think that's a big part of the romanticy appeal as well. These novels and the movies, they offer the escape, but they're often spaces for underserved narratives. So they really center women's stories. They're about sexuality in all its forms. They're unapologetically smutty. There's also a really important thread of romance and romanticy that's written by and about people of color as well. I think a lot of people assume it's a white woman thing, but that's not true. And we just shouldn't underestimate the power of BookTok, really. We know how huge it is. We know the influence it's having on the publishing industry. But one thing I find really pertinent to point out here is it's about personal recommendations. People aren't choosing books or films based on critics' lists anymore. They want really heartfelt discourse about people's personal responses to stuff. And romance fiction and film really moves people. And that's why it's finding such a huge audience.
Finally, what are some of the main key takeaways for today from this report?
So I think the big thing that there's the sense that people want what they want right now. I think people are more willing than ever to find the culture that they want in whatever form, whatever platform. People aren't loyal to platforms anymore. They are going to be looking in every direction. They continue to be led by values, but we shouldn't assume that we know what those values are. I think that's what we're seeing, that with the stuff that's happening with gender ideology as well. I think there's really interesting things happening with fandom. So we're going back to romance. I think brands should definitely be letting fans lead in how they want and what stories they want, but also how they want those stories to be delivered to them. I think we should be giving a lot more power to fans in terms of dictating what brand outreach looks like, what release schedules look like, and all of the rollout of marketing. I think we probably need to think more carefully about how we lean into nostalgia, because I think there's an element of it that isn't just buying Y2K clothes and watching old movies. People want these things actively to be part of their lives because of the security it offers them. And we need to look at the drivers for that nostalgia. People want that comfort, stability. They clearly want something simpler. So we should be helping them find something simpler, something that makes them feel like they're more connected to people. And yeah, I think the gender ideology one, sometimes brands can feel like they need to be a bit hands-off now in terms of how people are engaging in discourse. And people often don't want brands to intervene. But when it's something as significant as this, I think it's really important to let brands and businesses know that there's an opportunity to halt some dangerous thinking, and this is one of those key areas.
That's it for this edition of Future Thinking. I hope you enjoyed it and I'd love to hear your feedback. On X, we're at @stylus_live, and on Instagram and TikTok, you can find us at @WeAreStylus. See you next time.
You've been listening to Future Thinking from Stylus, the show where our analysts, alongside industry thought leaders, unpack the big trends that you need to know about. Find out more about what the future holds for your business at stylus.com. And if you like what you heard today, make sure you subscribe to Future Thinking in iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts to hear new episodes as soon as they're available.